Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, store news, and whatever games, movies, and TV is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show. Welcome to Roguecast, episode 258, and this week we are talking about comic books.
Yeah, surprisingly good week for something that I think at a glance I didn't think was going to be a notable week for me, but...
And I didn't get to read everything this week either, so there's probably some gems hidden in the...
Yep, and we'll even have, when we get to it, a mutual pick, a shared pick all of us, that no one could have guessed.
Before we get to all that, real quick, I'll run down the news. Modern Horizons pre-release is on Sunday. The results is the weekend you can buy Modern Horizons boxes and get the buy a box booster. Free RPG Day is Saturday, June 15th. Still time to sign up for those games. Great Austin Comic Con is Saturday, June 15th, Sunday, June 16th. We still have tickets. We will be there. And let's jump onto the news. We've got a bunch of potential news that we'll probably save, but there's some interesting stuff that came out this week we want to talk about. First up, Tom King last week had a bit of a reversal of fates in that he was sort of not going to be writing Batman as long as he wanted to, but he's got a Batman Catwoman. And we're like, well, what's this mean for him in DC? Well, it means he's probably at DC for a while because he is co-writing the New Gods movie with Ana DuVernay.
Yeah. She will be directing it and is co-writing it as well?
Co-writing as well.
Okay. And remind me, she is the director of the recent miniseries about the Central Park Five?
I believe that is correct.
Which is it a dramatization or a documentary? A
dramatization.
Okay. I've heard it's really good.
Yeah, I watched the trailer for it, and I was going to watch it, but it looked a little too heady for me.
In the wake of Chernobyl. Right.
What was the notable thing that Ana DuVernay did before?
She kind of had a bust with...
Wrinkle in Time.
Wrinkle in Time.
What did she do before that?
I remember it was something else that was kind of visually...
Selma.
It was not visually splendiferous.
Selma. That was really good.
I mean, it may have been in its way, but it was not, like, fantasy visual style.
No, Selma was really good.
Okay.
So, it is interesting that she is doing New Gods.
Yeah. I can only even guess at what, like, Tom King's approach will be, since he is such... His approach to, say, Mr. Miracle was so idiosyncratic.
Right.
I don't think that means that the movie is going to, like, mimic that style, but I do think it'll mimic that there will be kind of a deep human connection beneath the big explosions.
Yeah, there will definitely be more sort of, like, human characteristics. Yeah. Human characters instead of CGI Steppenwolves.
Right. And, you know, I'm not on the Tom King bandwagon overall, but I can absolutely get behind that as a general
can
philosophy.
Can we just get the Forever People in their giant...
Their dune buggy.
Their dune buggy
of
thing.
Of space.
Big Bear.
Yeah, dude. Yeah. I mean, that's awesome.
Yeah, well, here's the thing is, like, New Gods actually encompasses a ton of people. There's Orion, Light Ray, those guys, Mr. Miracle, Barda... all New Gods, as well as all the Apocalypse bad guys. So, do we have any notion as to what they're going to zero in on
for this?
I mean,
Mr. Miracle wouldn't be the craziest thing.
No,
yeah, I don't think it would. And that's possible.
He's the guy who broke out of fascism. So,
yeah,
sure.
Magic the Gathering has an animated Netflix show being produced by the Russo brothers.
Yeah, Russo brothers, aka directors of Avengers Endgame,
which led was it you, Dave, or someone on the comments on one of our threads. They must like things with titles with colons in them.
That was Chris Nicholas who made that witty comment. I just responded to it.
I will say this is the first time I've heard Wizards being smart in the sense of actually utilizing one of their properties.
Their license
to make an animated show. I'm like,
yeah, they've just been sitting on D&D for decades.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I guess Wizards is Hasbro Wizards has had it for a little while now.
They should really do a D&D cartoon.
I feel like
there might be an audience for that.
So, I wonder if this is the Russo brothers coming to this like, you have this property, this Magic the Gathering property. We'd like to do something with it.
It has millions of built-in followers.
I feel like the Russos are kind of like Lord Miller. They attach their name to a lot of stuff.
Probably so.
So like they've attached their name to a lot of stuff. But it's still that's a good pedigree, and I would love a good Magic the Gathering animated show.
Yeah,
I was suggesting in their hyphenated fascination that they should follow up with a new version of Metal Storm: The Legend of Jaredson.
Yes,
1983's finest offering.
You know, I remember whose philosophy it was Roger Ebert, who was like just remake bad movies.
Remake bad movies that had potential.
Is Jaredson one of those?
I don't know. I never saw that shit.
I don't say potential.
Was that Ebert? I thought it was Siskel.
I don't remember, to be honest. It was definitely one of them, and I'm not 100% sure which.
Yeah.
It could have been Siskel.
Yeah.
Anyway, whoever was a wise man.
Yes.
And if you've ever seen Maelstrom, The Legend of Jared Sin, let us know if it's a diamond in the rough, like Aladdin, or if it's just trash from the 80s.
Russell, we're going to need your opinion on Jared Sin. I'm going to talk to Russell every episode about it. Because Russell's the only person who emails me, unlike the rest of you lazy bums.
Yeah. He lets us know if he's seen things.
All right, there's also some trailers this week. Dark Crystal: Age of Resistance.
Yeah, I've posted about this on Facebook and stuff, but Dark Crystal is one of those properties that I think looks visually amazing. I always really wanted to like it because I like stop motion stuff and puppetry stuff. At least I like the weird three-dimensionality of it.
Yeah,
but the movie just never enthralled me. It's like boring, kind of morose. Even it's like it's not super fun.
There's no Secret of Nim.
It's no Secret of Nim. And I'm kind of hoping this can take the world setting and turn it into a more vibrant, compelling storyline. The trailer at least has the visuals down. I thought that it looked super cool.
Yeah, it looks really pretty. I've never seen the movie as far as I know. It's showing at the Paramount this summer, so I might go see it and I might watch.
And I too found the movie boring. Yeah.
There's, it is good for inducing nightmares in children. Like, along with Watership Down, it has very scary monsters.
The bad guys,
the Skeksis, the crab people. Even the cool things that are there, like, kind of, I think those sort of long strider horsey type things that they ride on, which are definitely people, like, real humans in, like, wearing, like, stilty things, sort of like the Wheelers in the Return to Oz, if anybody remembers that other nightmare-inducing movie.
That's true.
They look super cool, but they also look a little scary. They had, like, new characters, new Gelfling heroes in this, I think, as well as a few old favorites, like the little... Fizzgig, I think, is the little puffball dog thing. And then they had, I think it's Agra, I think, is the kind of the seer.
You've retained so much of this information
I read a little bit of the myth, creation myth comics, which I thought were actually pretty decent.
Okay.
I thought you were just making up words.
Nah, I could have been. but I saw the Dark Crystal itself, the Skeksis doing some crazy new experiment with it. They saw something called the Darkening in there that looks like it's, you know, like corrupting the land or something like that. Honestly, stock fantasy type stuff, but hopefully it'll be going through their filter of interesting design work.
And the package is beautiful. I mean, it is stunning.
Yeah, I think they've kind of taken what the original had and, if anything, kind of just sharpened up the colors and made it a little bit more vibrant. It looks pretty neat.
I'll be checking it out.
There's a trailer for The Kitchen, which is a Vertigo graphic novel by, was Becky Cloonan the writer or the artist on this? I think she was the writer?
Did she?
She's definitely involved in some way.
Oh, I hadn't forgotten that, honestly.
So y'all just rewatched the trailer. I watched it the other day. What's the premise in a nutshell?
So The Kitchen, I was looking at the graphic novel real quick. It is, Ming Doyle did the art, Becky Cloonan was covers.
Yeah.
Written by Ollie Masters. So it is the late 1970s in New York City. The Irish gangs of Hell's Kitchen rule the neighborhood. Their leaders are all in prison, so their wives keep running the rackets. And the male-dominated 1970s crime world wants nothing to do with these ladies running it. I loved this graphic novel. I didn't read the whole graphic novel. I read the first series and lost track of it. But I really enjoyed it.
Pretty straightforward crime stuff.
Yeah.
Not there's not like, and they have magic or something like that.
No, it's just a crime book.
Yeah.
Just a crime movie. And this has Melissa McCarthy,
Elizabeth Moss,
and Tiffany Haddish as the three sort of lead women. And this looks great.
It looks dark and kind of brutal. Yeah. And I think like one of the cops is, if I'm not mistaken, it's Common, right?
Well, and one of the guys, the Bill something, I don't remember his last name now, is the guy who's their like rival criminal. I love that guy in The Night Of and some other stuff. Yeah. Like, he's really good.
I had a weird thing where like this trailer didn't really grab me. I think part of it was Melissa McCarthy was weirding me out because I kept expecting her to make jokes and she was in serious mode.
Yeah, I was weird about that. I was surprised to see her in serious mode too, which looks good in that.
I know a lot of comedians who make the transition because every comedian has some dark inner.
She's made several sort of dark kind of dramas that have done really, really well. I mean, she was nominated for an Oscar last year for sort of, I forget what the movie was called, but yeah, it was really kind of dark.
I didn't know this either, Dave. It was a surprise to me, but Nick tells me.
It reminded me in a sort of superficial way of Widows from last year, where you had the wives of basically some criminals who get killed in like one really bad botched sort of heist, trying to sort of deal with the loose ends of their dead husbands, and also maybe stay afloat in the world by pulling off the lost heist. And I ended up really liking Widows quite a bit. Yeah.
This feels like it could be just a lost Martin Scorsese script.
It does, especially with the painted black and the music. Dave, is it possible that it looks like Elizabeth Moss's character is learning to become an assassin? That this fell under your no assassin
rule? I sensed an assassin on the edge of it, and I was like, nope.
Yeah.
It's possible.
Yeah. Your assassin radar went off.
Yeah. Although, there is an assassin in one of the books that you and I would almost both pick this week. So.
Yeah, it's interesting.
So we'll have to see. Maybe you're softening on assassins. Maybe. It's a nuanced position.
It depends on... I know what book you're talking about. Yeah, that's true. But it's not... the book is not an assassin franchise.
Right.
Nor does this movie, The Kitchen, look like it's all about assassins. No. It might be somebody... And Anna, here's the thing. I could roll with a realistic take on it. I think it's the sort of glamorized, you know, school of assassin stuff.
Okay,
or like... He's a normal guy, but he's also an assassin by night or whatever. The kind of the... I don't know.
So it wasn't that.
The hipstery, John Wick-y, and all that stuff.
Last trailer is the Onward trailer, which is a new Pixar movie set in a fantasy world that basically have jumped into modern times, so there's still, like, unicorns and lawn gnomes and dragons and all that kind of stuff, but
it's like conventional,
it's like
too.
Suburbia, yeah. And it is a...
You have a pet dragon.
A pet dragon. And it is a pair of brothers going on some kind of quest or possibly an errand, depending on which one you listen to. One of them voiced by Tom Holland, the other one voiced by Chris Pratt.
Yeah.
This looks like a ton of fun.
Well, that was Chris Pratt?
Yeah.
He was the one who was all, like, they were going to, like, run like just some errand to the grocery store or something, and he's like, it's a quest!
Yeah. Yes.
And Tom Holland is like, no. It seemed a little gimmicky to me, but it was like really looked really well done.
Well, it's a teaser. I mean, they're doing the big high concept.
Unicorns as raccoons is fun.
Unicorns as raccoons is what got me.
It's to me, it's like good for a short, but we'll see if it's good enough for a movie.
I mean, Pixar has a pretty good track record.
I thought you'd soured on them and decided Disney was the new king.
Disney is the new king, but Pixar has a good track record with original stuff.
Didn't you see the Toy Story 4 trailer and you're like, this interests me?
Yeah, well, that's a continuation of an existing universe that I think is a pretty good universe.
Although you haven't seen Toy Story 3.
It's true. I love Toy Story. But I will see 3 before I see 4, if I see 4.
I would recommend that.
What was I going to say about this? The thing that made me laugh and was when the dragon appears like a dog... And I'm like, okay, it's kind of a little too one-to-one, a little on the nose for me, but the spray bottle on the dragon made me laugh.
Yeah. I think we got a lot of the cutesy stuff here, but I think there's going to be more to the actual story, as always.
I'm sure there is.
Yeah. All right, that's it for news this week. We've got potential other stuff. We'll hold off on that for next week. And we'll be back in just a second to talk about comics.
One familiar cry.
We are talking comics week of Wednesday, June 5th, and we're going to start off with a book that we all liked and we all wanted to pick, and so we're all picking it.
Kind of out of left field, though.
Yeah, I expected to like this because the writer on it, Jed McKay, did the Man Without Fear series that I wound up really liking.
And while we're keeping it mysterious, I expected to not like it because this character never has like solo projects I particularly like, although I like the character.
Yeah. Especially in Roger Stern's Spider-Man, where they...
Yes.
Being mysterious. We're a really cool supporting character for quite a while.
Yeah, totally.
How much longer are we going
to
keep this?
If
I think we're about to end it.
Even if they are basically a ripoff of one of Batman's foes / love interests.
You're talking, of course, about Ra's al Ghul.
No, I'm talking about Catwoman.
Oh, right.
And the book is Black Cat.
Right. Black Cat, who started out as very much a Catwoman wannabe for Spider-Man, even... with a bit of a novelty that, at the time at least, and maybe this more or less persisted, she was kind of, it was the mystery of Spider-Man and the outlaw nature that allured her, that was interesting to her.
Yeah.
And back in the day when he would start to take the mask off, she'd be like, nope. Yeah. She's like, I don't want to know what
she dated Peter Parker. She'd want to date Peter Parker. She wanted to date Spider-Man.
Yep. Anyway, over the years, the character has evolved, and most recently, she's gotten bad luck powers from the Kingpin. Most recently, she became like a crime boss herself.
Yep.
I gather ran afoul of sort of a thieves' guild kind of thing.
I'm not sure. I didn't know
if that was new or not.
I think that's new. Dan Slott did this whole thing where she became... Superior Spider-Man ran across her. She didn't know it was Doc Ock in his body. He beat the crap out of her, and so she went villainous.
Yeah, and I don't think either of us really liked her as master villain. But they did, in this, one of the things that they did that I have to admire is they didn't just throw it out. They kind of acknowledged the time there, and she's kind of back to her kind of thief ways, mm-hmm, which is my favorite, Black Cat. Mm-hmm. But... There's a bit of past history that's kind of following her from the crime, yeah. Crime lord-ish moments.
Yeah, Nick, when he was talking about this, described it as sort of Ocean's 11-ish. And yeah. It does have that heisty vibe to it.
Kind of larger-than-life, kind of fun nature to it. Because she is being her sort of bantery self, mm-hmm, and doing the kind of heisty stuff. And it's
The key thing there is she has two partners, yep, in it.
I like
their original characters.
Yes,
I assume
they seem original to me, and they were both fun. I don't want to say too much about them, but they're not like super villains. They're just kind of heightened normal guys. But they're goons that both are kind of fun to be around in weird ways.
And they have their talents.
And
they have a there's a private security guy who's kind of like. She sort of flirts with, and he obviously respects her skills. And some kind of
what I liked is the book was super self-aware about that kind of cliche of the guy who's tracking her down who falls in love with her.
Yeah,
to the point where she's like, "You've got a thing for me, don't you?" almost immediately.
Yeah, they call out the tropes and subvert them in doing it. And I like that a lot. She's run afoul of the New York Thieves Guild, which is kind of cool. So she's got that. Thief rival. It all feels very familiar in this kind of thing. But it's well done, and they're aware of the cliches, and seems like they're maybe going to try to not step in them. And I think one of the things we all liked, without saying too much, is the reveal of the third person in her crew, or the fourth person in her crew, who is a Marvel character from of old who we really like.
Yeah. Kind of a cult character, not... I think under the radar for a lot of people, but... readers of Spider-Man might know him, and I'm not sure quite where else he's shown up, but if you know the character, you probably like the character, I bet.
There's also a backup story of just him that was probably one of my favorite things that I really liked.
One of the things it only now occurs to me is, just when I was trying to make the sign for this, I was like, Black Cat is like a very sexualized character.
Yeah.
She's like Catwoman, but with a perpetually unzipped top, mm-hmm, is sort of how it works. And Catwoman only sometimes has that. But they kind of avoided the overt sexualization in the comic. She's sexy. There's no doubt about it. She's in the suit. But they're not kind of doing these super lurid fan service shots.
Agreed.
I think they found a good balance for her. Because she's a character who kind of like... She likes to be slinky, sexy cat burglar.
Well, and she's back in her sort of classic outfit as well.
Best costume as far as I'm concerned. Even though some of the others have been all right.
Travel Foreman is the artist and does a fantastic job here.
Yes.
Yeah. All the characters are super fun. It was one of those ones where, like, a cast assembles of, like, you know, a few people, several people in pursuit of her, a few new allies to her. Everybody has a very distinct look, so there was, like, never any confusion in the panels. It's just, like, it all played out really cleanly and cleverly.
What this reminds me of, and to some extent, and what I think, that since Domino is sort of ending, for people who are looking for a replacement, this is a really good replacement.
That's an interesting point.
Also, a blueprint for a really good TV show / movie for Black Cat.
That's true. That's a good point.
You can just give her a kind of a cast around her, make her a badass.
I think
heistiness.
It would have to be in the Spider-Man verse for me to have an interest in it, because otherwise she gets too close to being just like a cat burglar. I think you actually could still do a good show out of that. Kind of the same way you occasionally get something weird like Gotham or whatever.
I'm saying you could do it in the Spider-Man universe.
Sony
has the rights here, so they would. Sony would love to be able to do some of these characters. Nod to Spider-Man, and you could do it.
Yeah,
well, they are doing, or have they said they're not doing the Black and Silver, which is the Black Cat and Silver Sable.
I think they might still be working on that.
Well, for like a decade or something like that, they had talked about they're going to do a Sinister Six movie, and they're going to do a Venom movie, and they actually did the Venom movie.
Yeah.
Now
they're wanting to bring the Venom movie into the Marvel Universe. which I'm fine with, actually.
I like the Venom movie quite a bit, actually. I don't think it's a good fit for the Marvel Universe, but I figure they could work it out if they did.
And I am deeply horrified by that notion.
It's less horrific than Deadpool getting in, and you know he's going to get in.
That's true.
But Black Cat, you're right. This is a template for that. I kind of wanted to like be its own thing and not have to get translated to film to be legit or anything.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no. I was just saying that's kind of a.
But yes, if they were going to do it, this is a way to do it where Spider-Man has no role in this at all. But it's a really good comic.
We should also mention that it has two backup stories in the back. Yeah, yeah. One of Black Cat and one of a character that will remain nameless at the moment.
Yep. And that was the backup is great.
Yeah. The short backup is like all sort of visuals and involves some actual cats. Yep. And is very adorable. It's beautifully drawn.
Yeah, I was looking to see who drew it.
Was it not both?
Nao Fuji.
Oh, okay.
Did so both.
How do you spell their name?
Nao Fuji. Is this the person that did the cat covers, the variant covers?
It's possible. I don't know.
I think that might be.
Oh, okay. Okay, but that was all one name, not like. Like two names.
It's now Nao and then last name Fuji.
Oh, okay, F-U-J-I. It is two names. Okay.
Yep.
Okay. So, yeah, Black Cat number one. Surprisingly good. Give it a read.
All right. So, I'm the person with a number one this week, so I'm going to start.
Yep.
And the book is Incredible Hulk number one. Incredible Hulk Last Call number one. I guess they're going to do a series of one shots for the Marvel 80th anniversary. And they might be trying to get up some of the classic teams together.
Yeah, like a classic creative team on the book will come and have like a last hurrah.
And so this is Peter David and Dale Keown, who did arguably the best of the Marvel Hulk, mm-hmm, until Immortal Hulk, which is great. And this is a one shot where it ties into Peter David's run to an extent that I almost wonder if people have not read the Peter David run, if they're gonna not connect with this.
Well, did you read the intro, Randy? Yes. Set it up perfectly. I haven't. I've read that run, but like 20 years ago. Okay. I didn't remember much from it at all. But all I needed to know was that something bad had happened to Betty, his girlfriend, and that he was at a low point. And that's really all you need to know. Everything else in the story is completely self-explanatory.
So Peter David did a few sort of very special stories for a while there. Yep. And one of them was a suicide hotline story.
Was that the one with
Betty talks somebody, tries to talk somebody down from suicide. He kept calling her back. Spoiler, she was ultimately unsuccessful, I think. But
was this one with the guy who had AIDS?
Yes.
Was that? Yeah. Oh, was that Jim?
Yeah.
His Hulk's old
no,
friend?
No. That was a separate part.
Okay, I was but mixing was, up two stories.
There was someone, it was like, he was a high school quarterback and he'd gotten AIDS and he was worried people were going to think he was gay and all this.
Right.
And so he basically, he was calling into a suicide hotline where Betty was working for a while under a pseudonym. Well, this has Bruce calling one of the women who she worked with just after Betty has died, because for a brief time during the 90s, 2000s, she was dead. And Bruce is like, you need to talk me out of this because I'm thinking about killing myself. I've hired an assassin.
And because she knows Betty, he can basically say kind of up front, I am the Hulk. Yeah, yeah, I'm the guy who's the Hulk. And he's like, I think I need to go this time.
And so in the course of this, we get a flashback to how he met Betty and their relationship together, and some bits of the Hulk, some bits of her as the Harpy. And there's a surprise supervillain appearance, which I should have seen coming, which was really well done. And a nice little finale. It's a good one-shot story. It's the kind of thing we don't see a lot of things in comics. And I was very, very pleased with this. And it reminded me of how much I like Peter David's run.
Mm-hmm. It was an optional pick, or a possible pick for me as well. And I thought it did, like, in the space of, what was it, probably like a double-sized issue or something that. It had like it had an emotive quality to it that reminded me of his run. It had beautiful art, and it had like some cool action in it too. But it was the parts that'll stay with me was the kind of the more thoughtful stuff of Bruce Banner ruminating on suicide is really well handled without being like morose.
Right, Dave, what you got?
I'm going with a book that I pick all the time, Criminal. But this issue was like so freaking good.
It really was.
The fifth issue of the book and the start of a new storyline. As far as I know, right?
Yeah, it's not continuing. It says on the front, new storyline.
Ah, fancy. and there's a quote on the front too that from Tom King, who all the kids love, says Criminal is easily one of the best comics of the 21st century. He's not lying. He might kill horses, but he's not a liar.
No, Batman kills horses.
Oh, right. When he's
at
writing
Tom
him.
At Tom King's direction.
At his behest.
At his behest.
Slay them, my pretties.
Hello, Batman. This is Tom King. Murder a horse.
So, So this is one of those stories that a lot of times in criminal, you have the story that on the surface, if you were to describe it, might sound pretty conventional, but it's the depth that the characters have in it that ends up winning me over. In this case, you've got a guy who's a private detective who's been tracking this woman, and when he finds her in a bar, and it seems like she's been on the run. She's very wary. He confesses who he is, and then the story kind of flashes back to what led him there, and he turns out to have an interesting life of like working for people he hates, like kind of rich guys who've had affairs with women, and the women go on the run, and he's got to go do their dirty work and like track them down. But he doesn't want to like let the guy stalk her. He's got a little bit of a heart, but you can kind of tell he's been through some stuff. He talks about being a cop, kind of being on occasionally taking money from criminals, not because he was like completely crooked, but because it was so expected that sometimes he just did it. And that's kind of the person he is. He sort of goes with the flow. And but what happens is that what you kind of think of as the cliche of him sort of starting to maybe develop a romantic interest in her, or kind of maybe somewhere between that and a paternal protective interest, as he finds out this path she's taken, and it does seem like she's no angel.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is he has a specific reason that kind of starts coming out of like why that fascinates him, and what it draws on from his history. And anyway, it was all just super compelling. There's like not a page wasted in here. It's a story that ends. What do you think? It's going to be a two-parter, maybe?
Two or three, yeah.
Two or three. And it ends with a great cliffhanger.
Yep.
That ends up tying it into another character from Criminal. But yeah, I don't know. I was just like every page something interesting. It's very dark. I was joking to Anna earlier about my fondness for darker comics, and that there's not much to laugh in here, except like in the previous issue, I'm like, the funniest thing was the dark humor of he accidentally killed the guy he meant to come back and like torture. I'm like, man, that's messed up. This one, though, is while there's a lot of darkness around it, the characters are very human, and this guy and the woman both have a kind of a humanity like percolating below it that keep them from being like just like noir characters I wouldn't care about. And incidentally, my other book that I'll be picking in a minute is a kind of lighthearted fun book to counterbalance it. But Nick, I believe, what do you have? I see death and despair.
Yes, you do see death and despair.
And savagery,
and that is in the form of Deceased number 2.
You have to say deceased.
Deceased.
Sure. The DC zombie? Is it fair to call it a zombie book?
Zombie-ish.
Yeah.
Because they're not craving brains, they're just craving death.
It is an alternate. We think this is outside of canon, right?
Yes, 100% outside of canon.
So,
it's a part of the multiverse, whatever, in whatever world this might be. A plague created,
kicked off by the
anti-life equation,
which was a cool idea.
A mutated anti-life equation.
Yeah.
Has basically infected the world after destroying Apocalypse. Mm-hmm. And this issue sort of sees some of the fallout as things continue to go from bad to worse. But while I didn't like the first issue as well, I mean, I thought it was a solid idea.
We all thought, I think that was where we all were. We're like, Tom Taylor wrote some good scenes, the idea, the hook was kind of there, but none of us were like, yeah, this is what we want him doing.
Yeah, but the second issue is much better.
Yeah, the second issue is better. I say fun in quotation marks because Tom Taylor writes a good scene,
yeah.
And he uses characters, the same characters that he's been using since Injustice.
Yeah.
So you have Harley Quinn, Green Arrow. These are sort of icons for him.
He wrote some of the best scenes I've ever seen with those characters in the space of that video game spin-off comic Injustice.
Yep.
Yes. So he sort of gives them the limelight, spotlight a little bit, and you know, Damian and Superboy are involved, and Superman, and
I saw this. I just started to read this, and I was like, man, the art is so good in it.
Yep, Trevor Hirsine.
Yeah, Trevor Hirsine.
Best I've ever seen from him. But there was a scene where the super sons were talking, and I forget if it was Damian or...
Damian. John Kent.
Jonathan Kent. But one of them says something like, I'm 70% sure this is the end of the world, or something like that. And I was like, I don't particularly like the individual book with those characters. Like, it's just not for me. It's a little too tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah.
But I was like, this is a really good scene with them.
Yeah, their banter back and forth feels kind of what you'd expect from two kids.
It's kind of what Tom Taylor does, which is sometimes take something I might not be into otherwise.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say.
And make it work for me.
That's his thing. That's what he does. He writes good character moments. There's some great stuff with Hal and Black Canary.
Yeah, and Ollie.
And Ollie.
There's a great scene with Harley Quinn.
Scene with Harley Quinn? Yeah.
Sort of an epitome of that character and her dealing with something that she's needed to deal with.
You know what they need to do is they need to let Tom Taylor write a miniseries with her, and then Stefan Sedgwick needs to do the Harley and Ivy miniseries.
I agree.
But I'm curious to see where they go with this, because I'm not sure, but it's interesting to see kind of the heroes sort of come together, band together. There's some big stuff that happens towards the end of this issue.
Yeah,
that
I really
don't
want to
spoil.
Yeah. I really like Tom King writes a great Batman,
and he
likes really good Superman. And it's interesting to see him writing a traditional Superman instead of a power mad dictator Superman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And interesting for him to be writing a regular Batman instead of a last hope of humanity Batman.
But this is not a happy book.
No, it is not a happy book.
And it definitely punctuated by the end of this issue of how unhappy it is.
Two major characters die in this book.
I guess with this actually has some of the same advantages that Injustice did, which is he's off the grid, so he can kind of break the toys if he wants.
Yeah. This is a less tongue-in-cheek, more artfully done version of Marvel Zombies.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Marvel Zombies was always a goof, and this is more serious.
This is definitely
How long is it?
I think it's a 6-issue... Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's 6-issue series.
Okay, cool. So he's going to have some time to let it breathe and figure out, I assume there's the twists and turns will continue.
I would expect so.
Long enough to let it breathe, not long enough to be so delayed that it takes 4 years to come out.
Correct. Right.
Is that a thing?
Not 4, 3.
What are we talking about?
Doomsday Clock.
Okay. I was like, you're being so oblique, I don't know what you're meaning. There's a lot of delayed comics.
There are a lot of
Doomsday
delayed
Clock,
comics.
Watchmen, Camelot 3000, whatever.
Sure, we were just talking about Black Cat today, and Kevin Smith wrote an epically delayed Black Cat miniseries
once. Wasn't that like 5 years?
It was crazy, yeah. I don't think it took quite as long as his Daredevil the Target, miniseries, which was like 10 years to
I forgot they actually finished that.
Yeah.
My backup pick is another number two, and that is Savage Avengers number two, the Conan Marvel crossover that I never thought I'd want to see again, because we did get the Cullen Goth, and Cullen Goth is back.
Yep.
Which, it's kind of awesome. I mean, Mike Deodato Jr. is killing it in the artwork.
We discussed it. Nobody should be allowed to draw Brother Voodoo or Dr. Voodoo. Is he doing it by Dr. Voodoo?
I think he's Dr. Voodoo.
Nobody should be allowed to write Jericho Drum except him.
Yeah. Or Wolverine.
Or to draw him,
Or Wolverine stabbed by like 60 arrows.
Right. Frank Miller gets to because he invented that.
Yeah.
Yes, but Deodato does a pretty damn good version of it.
Yeah, his art is beautiful in this.
But I will say, it's a fun second issue. There's a continuation of what's going on in the... why Conan is here, what he's after, why Wolverine is here, why... Dr. Voodoo, Punisher is here. So this is sort of the big setup, but also lots of Wolverine killing things.
Okay.
And it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I really liked it too. That series has proved to be much more fun than I thought it might be.
And I will say, Deodato he does Conan incredible justice. I mean, just the way he draws
and
has this
hulking... I would say Conan and Cullen Goth.
Yeah, Cullen
Goth
awesome.
Is like a wispy, nasty wizard, man. nasty wizard.
Dave, what's your backup pick?
My backup pick is the second issue of Batman Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 3.
I think you have to say the title of
that. All right, I will, because I forgot to do it before. I'm going to say how the first issue ended, since it's we're an issue out in it.
Yeah.
The first issue revealed that the weird, crazy mashups we saw where Batman had been like merged with... he was like trained in ninjutsu by like his father figure Splinter, who's clearly in the role of Alfred, and all of this. There's like the Donatello or whatever, like they had been combined with some of the Robins, that there was a Crisis on Infinite Earths type thing happening. There's the red skies and everything, only this time the Anti-Monitor has submerged in his chest the
Krang,
the Utrom, is that what they call him?
Mm-hmm.
The aliens that do that? Yeah.
Utrom.
So, yes, an amazing visual of Krang inside the giant anti-monitor manipulating events. And the title of this was Crisis on a Half Shell.
Such an awesome title.
And it appropriately hits the ridiculousness. At the end of the issue, some craziness showed up where Raphael arrived, only it was Raphael from the original 1984 Ninja Turtles in black and white and everything.
Oh, that's crazy.
And he's like, I'm from the Prime Universe. I was the original Raphael. And they are aware of it. And he's like been chasing Krang from his universe through these universes. And there's like there was a reason why these matchups are going on and that Krang is manipulating these via the anti-monitor.
That sounds bonkers, but it also sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
He recaps their origin, which was really fun. It reminded me of like how much fun the old black and white Ninja Turtles were.
Who's doing the art on this?
It looks like it's one of the Ninja Turtles guys, like Eastman or Laird, but I believe
Is it Freddie Williams?
He's mimicking it perfectly, even to the point where. Like, they did that duotone black and white shading on it. But it is kind of meta because, like, the in-color Ninja Turtles of this, they're like, that's Raph, right? Like, weird Raph? It's like somebody freaking Xeroxed him and took his clothes away because he doesn't have, like, cool Robin costumes like they have. Anyway, this is the issue kind of where you find out everything that's going on. And here's the other thing. There is, like... Dick Sprang Batman alternate world in it too. Nice. It is like there's like multiple different incarnations.
This truly
it looks
is
like
a crisis.
It looks like it's going to involve like the original black and white Ninja Turtles teaming up with think of him as Brave and the Bold Batman.
Yeah.
Brave and the Bold Batman and some of the others to try and get to the bottom of things. let's see, how many issues is this
Six.
Supposed to be? Six issues. So there's still plenty of time for this one to have its own crazy twists and turns. Anyway, it is just a blast. It makes me want to read the other ones and maybe even buy them just to like kind of get the fun backstory on this. But this is its own thing. You don't need to have read any of the others.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm very much enjoying this ridiculous book.
Randy, what is your backup pick?
So I had several possibilities, but I'm going to pick a trade this week. A ridiculously cheap $10 trade. This is Die from Image by Kieran Gillen and Stephanie Hans. And Nick, you and Anna and a few other people have been sort of on board this book from the beginning.
Yeah, which I'm actually very surprised you're picking this because normally you're not a big fan of Kieran Gillen.
I'm not always a big fan of Kieran Gillen, and I like the guy, but I haven't liked Wicked and Divine, and I thought this was another thing like that, and I figured, okay, it's probably not for me. And then I was on vacation, I had a preview copy to read, and I read it, and it's fantastic. So this is... I think we've talked about a little bit on the podcast before, but if you don't know, this is basically a what if the D&D cartoon took place and was kind of real, and if these kids, basically instead of just having an adventure, if they went for like 2 or 3 years and then came back kind of traumatized by what they saw over there. And then it jumps ahead 25 years later, and these kids are having to go and rescue the one friend they left behind. And
it's a little bit of shades, I suppose, of It, where the adult versions have to kind of deal with something remaining from the past.
I was going
to
say, it feels a little Stephen King to some extent, too.
Yeah.
But basically, this guy was having a birthday party, and so one of their friends made a role-playing game for them. They each got one special dice, which represented their class, and then they were that class in the other world. And the classes are kind of cool. There's, like, the... The dictator. They describe what they have. They're like, so there's the dictator who is like their bard basically, and they get a D4. There's the grief knight who's their paladin. There's Neo who's kind of a like weird cybernetic wizard thing. There's the godbinder which is their cleric. There's the fool who's kind of another fighter type. And then there's a.
It's a little bit like if somebody who was like. Kind of more into like Vampire the Masquerade did their version of D&D. It's kind of like the hipster kids doing their D&D or kind of going off
like,
the beaten
like
path.
Exalted when White Wolf had their like slightly different.
Yeah.
Because it is very much a fantasy world, but like bad things have happened in this world. There are different realms, they're different and there are different allies they have, and the level of power these guys are working with is very, very different. But it's interesting, and their friend has clearly gone a little insane when he's back in the world, and they can't leave unless they all agree to leave, and so they've got to decide whether they can try to win him over or if they've got to kill him. And there's a lot of character stuff going on, like their lives have not gone great. Some of them have divorces and custody issues. Some of them have failed relationships, and there's all that tying into it too.
Characters are pretty deeply written,
yeah,
you would say.
Yeah,
very much
so. It's a really good story. It's a really satisfying first arc. This trade is a great addition because it's got all variant covers. It has essays from Kieran Gillen talking about how he came up with all the various characters. And it actually has a link to the PDF of the actual role-playing game if you want to playtest it for them. So, yeah, it's really fun. Again, $10 for this giant trade is a crazy deal. So I would definitely recommend
it. And it's already been doing well. I have a feeling it's going to do very well as a trade. Yeah. People might as well get on
this
board.
This is going to be on a lot of lists. It's going to get an Eisner nod. It's definitely going to be one of the big books. Also on my list this week, Ignited number one, which is Mark Waid and Kwanza Asefcho doing a new shared superhero universe that spins out of a school shooting, basically. Mm. And something results in the kids sort of getting powers. And it is all about these kids at the school sort of rising up against the gun culture that didn't protect them. And there's like one kid whose mom is a cop and his dad is like this militia dude, and they decide they're gonna escort their kid to school wearing guns. And there's a couple of like viral sensation teenagers who are doing something. They basically do this big sort of school activism prank kind of thing where they say, look, if the school doesn't strike, if the teachers don't strike in response to this, we're gonna arm the teachers, then you're all gonna suffer. Basically, they say you're gonna have a case of diarrhea. You're gonna have an epic case of diarrhea tomorrow, and that comes to pass.
Uh-huh.
And it's interesting. It's Mark Waid has a bit of a troubled record writing teens.
Right, right. We talked about this off mic, but like his run on Legion of Superheroes had some really neat ideas, but also some awkward, felt like 40-year-old guy writing teens.
Yeah, Mark Waid is in his late 40s, early 50s. He's not the guy who really gets teens, but. That said, within those parameters, I thought this was a pretty solid first issue.
I need to read that. And the art looked nice, too.
Yeah, and really nice art. An interesting take on a superhero universe. Buffy number 5, which has a big twist for the characters. Thumbs number 1 from Image, which is a futuristic... I don't know quite how to describe it. Futuristic 1% kind of... like the kids rising up against an evil government kind of thing. Beast of Burden number 2, which I'm really enjoying that. Tony Stark Iron Man number 12, which is co-written by Gail Simone, and Tony Stark Fights the Dragon, which is a War of the Realms crossover, as is Captain Marvel number 6 this week, which sees her and Black Widow teaming up against Enchantress. Meet the Skrulls number 5, which I believe is the penultimate run of that issue. Green Lantern number 8, which is Morrison's riff on the hard-traveling heroes. And then Valiant's Fallen World number 2, which is their sort of post-apocalyptic 4001 AD adventure. Dave, what else is on your list?
I just want to mention the Guardians of the Galaxy Annual, which actually even haven't had time to read the whole thing, but I believe it has a framing story by Donny Cates. And what you're doing is in the first issue where all those cosmic heroes had gathered, a lot of them, what do they call Thanos' guards people?
His Black Order.
The Black Order, trapped all these guys in black holes, right? Or in a black hole, or sent them off to the far-flung corners of the universe. And this is kind of catching up on all of them.
Yep.
And then with a couple other writers doing the stories, you're kind of finding out what happened to Nova, what happened to, Darkhawk, Quasar.
Or Warlock.
Warlock, yeah. Those guys are all profiled. I read just enough to see that it looked pretty good, and I think you liked it, Nick.
Yeah, I did.
So,
I like Al Ewing, and he did some great nods to the Adam
Al Ewing of Immortal Hulk fame.
Yep.
That's actually the only other one I had that was of note this week, though. There's still a fair amount I haven't read.
No. And I just have a couple. War of the Realms number 5, which is the penultimate issue. Continues to be quite good. This is a lot of action occurs in that one. The Young Justice number 6, which is the finale to the first story arc. There are definitely some twists and turns in this. Bendis, we finally get to find out Team Lantern and where her powers come from and how she sort of fits into the larger DC universe. I thought it was actually rather awesome. Batman number 72 is a pretty notable issue, sort of running down all of Tom King's entire run through a voice we haven't heard before.
Batmite.
Not Batmite. We've seen Batman, I'm sure. But
Beautifully drawn by several artists, but especially Michael Janin, sort of aping the David Mazzucchelli style of Batman Year One.
It's crazy good looking. Yeah. I wish I liked Tom King's writing more, because like I look at this book and it's almost the best drawn book I've seen this whole week.
Yeah, Michael Janin gets to sort of flex his muscles as a cloning David Mazzucchelli and then using his style. Yeah.
I gotta say, like, some people clone stuff and I'm like, ugh. But, like, his looks super good.
Yeah. And it's the same way that the guy who did, Freddie Williams, is doing the Turtles. I mean, it looked like
Eastman and Laird. Yeah, it looked like Eastman and Laird, yep.
And then Shazam number 6, which, sort of a big event happens for Billy here, sort of getting in touch with his, original family, but also stuff going on with his foster kids, sort of all the different realms of the fantasy lands are kind of colliding. Magic is in flux. Mr. Mind is showing up.
Is this the finale of what will be the first trade, Nick?
I think it's got one more issue left for kind of its big...
Okay. Is that issue 6, and I wasn't sure if they were going to collect it weird, or if it's going to be a 12-issue trade, or what?
It might. I'm not 100% sure, but Geoff Johns continues to pull out some pretty good stuff in Daily Gushim. I've always loved his artwork.
So people who've been enjoying the movie should still be checking this out. Yeah,
definitely if you enjoyed the movie.
Because it's got all the kids in it, right?
It does have all the kids. Savannah, Black Adam, yep. Mr. Mind. It is sort of a who's who of all things Shazam.
Given how close the miniseries that Johns did a few years ago was to the movie, right. I mean, like, really the template for the movie...
This
you may well be seeing Shazam 2 in this.
Right, and this is definitely a continuation.
Yeah,
for sure. All right, we're going to take a break, and then we'll come back and talk about some TV shows and movies.
Talking about comics, movies, and fame. They even talk about board games. No week is the same.
All right, so we wanted to real quick talk about a movie that Dave saw.
And Nick.
And I saw.
And Nick saw, and I have not seen yet. And then a show. So, spoilers for the live-action Aladdin and for DC's first episode of Swamp Thing in the DC Universe app. So, let's talk about Swamp Thing first.
Sure.
I think I was not super hyped for this, just because I was like, I like Swamp Thing, but even like Alan Moore's Swamp Thing, I don't adore.
Right, and I have a fondness for Swamp Thing from the cheesy 90s movie. And
actually, 80s originally.
I was 80s originally.
It was like 1981 or 80 or something like that, the original Wes Craven one.
With Heather Locklear and...
That was, I think, the follow-up, because the original had Adrian Barbeau. Barbeau. Okay, so what you had seen was the sequel.
I saw the sequel.
Yep.
So, yeah, even worse.
Nick, am I remembering right? Did they, over a montage of art of probably like... Bernie Wrightson and other stuff like that. Did they play Born on the Bayou?
I believe they did.
Over the opening credits?
I believe they
just
did.
Checking? That was my memory.
And I read some of Alan Moore's. I was never super enamored with it. I read Anatomy Lesson, and I read a couple of things, but didn't leave a lasting impression on me.
So this one is, it's set in Marway. Is it Marway, Louisiana, I think is the name of it?
And is that an invented town?
I believe it is,
invented,
yes.
So they don't have to worry about it. Because Louisiana is traditionally the place. They invented a town.
Sure, good idea.
I think it's a great idea.
Abby Arcane, when we first see her, she's the Swamp Thing's like love interest and notable character. They have made her a like CDC doctor operative kind of person. And we first heard she is in the Congo, sort of dealing with an outbreak there.
Yes.
And she gets called back to Louisiana because there's some kind of crazy rapid plant growth and illness going on.
I think this is a great update for her.
It's
character.
A really good update because she comes back. She has issues in this town. She has you know, personal issues and family issues and that kind of thing. And so she's got her family stuff going. Alec Holland is sort of this renegade scientist working for the Sunderland Corporation, who he clearly doesn't really like. Sunderland Corporation owns everything, and they've got a reason to personally dislike Abby.
And Sunderland is Will Patton.
Is Sunderland, by the way, the... Oh, Will Patton, that's a good cast.
Yeah, Will Patton is great.
Is he the old man from the Anatomy Lesson?
I think he might be.
Is.
Oh, man. That's pretty cool. So they've taken that story and kind of blown it up into probably what would be a bigger story.
Yeah, so he's... Will Patton is Avery Sunderland. Virginia Madsen is the wife who has this really intense scene with Abby in the bar.
Yeah, it's good.
She's
where great.
It's clear that Abby... Something happened with their daughter, who Abby was friends with, whether it was a drug overdose or drunk driving or something like that, where Abby got her killed.
Mm.
And she feels guilty about it, and she didn't want to come back because of it, and she is sort of... Virginia Madsen's character basically threatens to run her out of town on a rail as soon as she can, if she doesn't stop this, and as soon as she's done, she wants her out of town, and that kind of thing. There's a meet cute and sort of a burgeoning romance between Abby and Alec. They're Alec Holland is played by Andy Bean. I think he's really great. He's
I didn't recognize him.
I don't know him either.
It's good. Alec Holland as a character in the comics that I've read and in flashbacks and stuff in Swamp Thing has never been a really potent character. No. He was more interesting as Swamp Thing when he became this weird elemental thing. So I'm glad that they've got somebody good playing him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the most notable is how they sort of interpret the green and...
Do they use that term?
Not yet. Not yet. But I could definitely see it coming.
I really like their Alec Holland, though. He's
yeah, got this he's good.
He's got this quirky vibe to him. He's like, a guy who walks around in sandals.
Okay, I was going to ask, is he quirky like Jeff Goldblum in The Fly?
Ish.
That's my high water mark for quirky scientists that are likable.
But I thought they did a really good job sort of developing all the characters and developing this... Someone's mysteriously dumping these boxes in the swamp that are.
Is this all based on one episode, or have there been two?
One episode.
Just one.
They're dumping these things that seem to be causing like this rapid growth of plants. There's some really creepy stuff where like some guy has been infected and there's an autopsy of him like and he's covered in plant material.
It is something out of John Carpenter's.
Yeah, I heard it likened to The Thing because that had a famous autopsy scene on a partially changed person.
But the way they. It's a small thing, but the way their vines move, it's got this kind of real jumpy nature, sort of stop motion animated style. A little bit of that
Silent Hill-y, Jacob's Ladder.
And all of it's got the whole show has a great edge to it.
Yeah.
Because it is dark, but...
R-rated?
Yeah. Oh, God, yes.
Okay.
They're not with, like, the cursing and language, like Doom Patrol.
It's more that body horror
it's
weirdness.
The body horror.
They're definitely going into the body horror stuff.
And I know James Wan's producing this.
Yeah.
I don't know how much of his involvement, but I can certainly see his fingerprints.
Some of that Insidious. Yeah.
By the way, there are some nods here that lead me to believe that we're going into sort of a supernatural direction, too. That they're going to mix the corporate, malfeasance and ecological stuff along with sort of the magic aspects. Madame Xanadu shows up.
Really?
They cast a African-American woman who is, like, in the bar. It's like just a little cameo.
I need to watch this. I missed that.
Because as Abby's walking into this old bar that she used to know that's, like, on in the bayou, and she's with Alec, and she looks up, she's like, Madame Xanadu's still here. Surprised she's still alive, and it's, like, this older black woman. And I'm so
I was wondering if they were going to have any DCU fit stuff at all that wasn't just straight out of Swamp.
We know they cast the Blue Devil.
Yep.
Oh, that's right. I guess we knew that way back.
And also, just looking at IMDb, they mentioned Jason Woodrue, of course.
Yeah. That I assumed he would show up as along with Anton Arcane.
And also, Matt Cable is here as like a sheriff's deputy, maybe, who's like Abby's old friend.
Okay.
She was her husband, right?
Right.
I think so.
Here he is more like a childhood friend kind of thing. We'll see how that arc. So it's playing tribute to the Alan Moore stuff.
Yeah.
And the Len Wein stuff, but it is definitely... blazing its own path.
This sounds like a good expansion on it. I'm definitely planning to catch it. It's the thing for me is like I wasn't sure what the tone would be, but the trappings you've mentioned, which sounds like they took the comics and expanded on it in the way a lot of TV shows will do when they take a movie or something that had been smaller before and make it bigger.
Yeah.
And it sounds like they've made good choices in that.
It's smart.
It's easily the best pile of DCU has produced.
It's got good. Characters is really notable.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. I came around on Doom Patrol, and I came around to some extent on Titans.
Right,
but neither of them have a first episode anywhere near as strong as this.
Interesting.
Also, by the way, the guys behind this, Mark Verheiden, who's done a ton of stuff.
Yep.
And Gary Delberman, who is the screenwriter for the Conjuring spinoff universe and the film adaptation of It.
Conjuring spinoff mostly have been bombs for me, but. It was solid, and
I still can get some fun out of the Conjuring stuff regardless.
I'm a little torn on the next Annabelle movie because it's got the original Conjuring people in it.
I know.
And, like, it looked kind of fun in the trailers, but I've, like, Annabelle has burned me twice. Do I a third time and
I like die? Annabelle, so I'm not a sucker. I guess I'm a glutton for punishment.
The guy playing Alec Holland is going to be in It Chapter 2 playing Stanley Uris.
Oh, he's one of the kids. Yeah.
So, anyway,
speaks well that he is that y'all liked him then.
Yeah.
The other thing we want to talk about is Aladdin, which I have not had a chance to see, and I kind of want to based on the buzz.
I think we can avoid spoilers and such as there are spoilers of a live action adaptation. This is one of the ones that's it's pretty close to the movie.
Yeah.
They expanded some things.
They expanded some things that needed to be expanded on in this day and age.
Right. Well, I'll just give a quick example. Jasmine's dad, the Sultan, is not the little gnomish doofus that he was in there who didn't notice that Jafar was cackling evilly behind every, you know, turn.
I actually really liked their Jafar.
Their Jafar was interesting. You know, one of our coworkers, Kate, was like, this movie looks like it sucks based on, like, the one line Jafar had in the trailers. It's like he didn't, because she wanted cackling evil with, you know, enjoyable malice. And he sounded a little more weaselly. And it is kind of true. He's a little bit more of an insidious guy. He's like this hawkish advisor, but he's not somebody you would think, well, if I can control him, he is smart, and he knows what he's doing on a lot of things, as long as I just curb his more dangerous impulses.
But I thought his backstory by like kind of giving it a kind of a mirror image of Aladdin, but
His own version of it that made them interesting sort of rivals in a way that I did not expect.
And I thought it was great.
That was cool, let's go ahead and jump into the elephant in the room, which is the genie in the room.
Yep.
Which is Will Smith taking on the legendary role, probably the most iconic role that Robin Williams ever played.
Yep.
Everybody was scared of it, everybody thought the special effects looked like crap. I ended up liking him quite a bit.
The blue genie is still a little weird looking.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where, like, it's almost by its nature it had to be, because he does some of the same things that Robin Williams does.
Yeah.
But he's, like, got this muscly CG body, which I guess means he's probably CG most of the time.
Most of it.
With a, probably a what do you, like the face of Will Smith for sure.
It's mo-capped mixture.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's an amalgamation of things. And sometimes it looks good, and sometimes I'm like, that looks strange.
I'll agree. I think there's a few times, like, it could have been better for sure. But like, it was not something that I felt like was really brought the movie down. It was just one of those, too bad it wasn't perfect all the
time. But they get around this by Will Smith looking like himself amongst, not all the time, but a lot of the time.
Yeah, so, one other thing I was going to say is, the genie is as much Will Smith's personality now as it was Robin Williams before. He's using a lot of the same lines, and the songs are similar, but there's different, lots of different lyrics, too.
There are.
But yes, you see him as transformed into a human to kind of go in and advise Aladdin, so he gets to look like Will Smith.
Yeah.
And in fact, there's kind of a neat framing device that involves him in that role in the opening, where the opening song, the Arabian Nights song, is sung by him, which I guess it was sung by Robin Williams, was it not?
Nope.
Okay, well, in the original, it's what, like a peddler or something like that?
Well, the peddler is voiced by Robin Williams. I don't think he actually sings it.
Right. Doesn't he?
He's
like,
so.
I come from a land, from a faraway place. Like, he's...
Maybe.
I don't know.
It's been a little while.
It opens with a song.
Yeah, but here it's the genie doing it, and I enjoyed all the songs in it. Nick, I think you noted, and it is true, Will Smith does not have the vocal range that Robin Williams did.
I would have had him play into rapping more.
Yeah.
I feel like he would have done that a bit better. I believe it's Alan Menken who originally did the music for this. I mean, his songs are very operatic and kind of forms and things.
Right. They call for like some highs and lows that he maybe can't achieve. But they did, I think, because of the attitude they threw at him, like, you know, the Prince Ali song?
Yeah.
I thought it was great.
Yeah.
And really played to the bravado of Will Smith. And there is even a little bit of, like, a little hip-hop spin here and there.
Yeah.
I
think that played to his strengths. I actually really liked the people they cast for Jasmine and Aladdin themselves.
It was great. Finally, I guess, you know, a rare case, but with something we see increasingly often, and I'm glad they get shouted on when they don't, of casting the actual intended race of the characters.
Yeah, everybody in here is of the right, like, Middle Eastern...
Yep.
So
Aladdin is charismatic and cocky and sweet and all the things you would kind of want him to be.
But I think both of you and I were very happy that they gave him a lair.
Yes.
Which is so
sweet. Yeah, Aladdin's got his own, like, kind of like a little falling apart tower in the city, but it's kind of like he's fixed it up in a way you really only can in movies, where it's actually pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty
awesome.
There's
pulleys and stuff.
Everybody wants that.
Yep.
I mean,
let's see. Apu, the monkey, and the tiger, and Raja.
And carpet.
Are all, let's see, they're all like, I mean, like, wait, what's the name of the tiger?
Raja.
Raja,
Raja looks great. I actually think the effect was fun.
But didn't get as much maybe screen time.
No.
But they are like more like a little more like animals than they were before. And definitely like there's no Gilbert Gottfried voice for Iago.
No, I believe that was in fact Alan Tudyk.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
So he does normal sort of repeating stuff as well as some smart-ass lines, but he's not like, I'm just going to talk.
And Abu, I believe in the only person reprising his role is actually Frank Welker.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, who actually did the voice.
Oh, that's crazy. I didn't know that. Stuff that's for that's what's his name? I'm best known for the voice of...
Megatron.
Megatron, yeah.
Yeah. I mean... That those circles are very small, so voice acting is kind of like everybody.
If you're a big name, you get to be in everything.
Yeah.
Nick, let's quick talk about Jasmine's slightly expanded role. She gets an original song in this, and they kind of try and beef up her role a little bit, I think, so she's not just kind of the princess to be wooed.
Yeah, she actually wants to be Sultan, and I actually think that is a really great storyline for her to have.
Oh, and they also added some more backstory about her mother, too.
Yep.
And, the country where she comes from, and it involves the present. So, and now that I think about it, they essentially deepened the story in Aladdin,
yep.
But all the basics are there, including almost all the songs you know.
Yeah. Her song was fine. I wish it had been kind of meshed with the story a little bit better.
It does pop a little bit as being, like, a good song. It reminded me of, like, the big song in Wicked.
Yeah.
Was it, what do you call that song?
I don't remember.
Flying sword, something, whatever it is. It reminded me of that song, but it did feel a little out of place.
Yeah.
But it was a good song.
It was
fun. And I think
she had a great voice. She actually has the more operatic voice as opposed to Will Smith.
That's true.
So it worked.
Oh, you know what I was going to say? I loved the, the One Jump song that Aladdin does, which is kind of one of the funnest songs where they're on the run from the law, and there's a tweak to that scene too. I won't quite say what it is, but it's not exactly how it happened in before. But one of the things I like is seeing in live action the guards chasing him and the guards suddenly singing along with the song, you know, because that's how it works in the thing. Like, he'll do his line and then they're suddenly saying something all in unison, angry guard style. Was a lot of fun.
Well, honestly, I mean, I think this is probably the best live-action movie they've done so far.
For me, it's still... I still like Jungle Book best. I found that that's not necessarily divisive, but, like, some people, like Randy, I think you and I both liked it quite a bit, and I really liked it.
I did, too. I liked it as well.
But like, I know a few people who overtly don't like it. And it took the most liberties. It was as much a rebuild, almost as, like, Maleficent was a rethink of Sleeping Beauty. But yeah, I would say that one is still in the number one spot for me. This one is the second spot though, and is pretty close.
Guy Ritchie did a good job with it.
Yeah, and I know you and I were both a little bit nervous because we almost died watching his terrible, awful King Arthur movie, the worst movie of all time.
But I still love Guy Ritchie. I mean, Snatch, Lock, Stock, Two Smoking Barrels.
It's good to know that somebody who's got talent can make a bad movie and not become a bad director. That there's, you know, Shyamalan did the same thing. He made several bad movies, and then he has kind of come back.
I don't know how this did overall, like, box office wise. I'm sure it did well.
I believe it opened strong, but it did get dethroned by Godzilla.
Right.
On its, like, second or third week.
Well, yeah, Godzilla could beat a genie.
That should be our next store poll. Could Godzilla beat the genie from Aladdin, specifically? Anyway, I don't want to go into too many more specifics, but no. I think people should check it out.
Yes, definitely.
All right. People will. By people, I mean me.
We'll do a little follow-up addendum when you see it, Randy.
I liked it. Or I hated it. Dan, Nick are wrong.
They're stinkheads.
That'll do it for us this week. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next time with more. And until that time,
yo, Joe!
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating and review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.